Hello, I'm Paul Scott. Today I'm doing a Q&A session with Tom Salmon of Spreadex. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Paul.
Thanks very much for agreeing to do this. Basically, all the questions I'm going to ask have come from my blog readers on Stockopedia.com, where Graham Neary and myself write a daily small caps report called Small Cap Value Report. So with the purpose of this audiocast is very much focused on small cap spread betting. There's been lots of interest. We've had 26 questions submitted by readers, so I've had to condense them down a bit. And this audiocast is aimed at experienced investors only, not beginners. So we'll assume that listeners understand spread betting. And Tom, do you want to do the sort of standard risk warnings about spread betting, please?
Yeah, I can do. Yeah, no probs. So it's important just to clarify that spread betting does carry a high level of risk to your capital and can result in losses larger than your initial stake or deposits. It's not suitable for everyone, and it's important that everyone understands the risk fully involved before they start, and it's only available to those people over 18 years of age.
Okay, great. Thanks for that. So, yeah, as I say, the focus is on small caps here. Now, Spreadex is the clear market leader in small caps, and I do about 80% of my family small cap stuff is done through Spreadex. I'm very happy with the company and the service. So, I mean, do you want to outline what you do in the small cap space, what you offer, Tom?
Well, we try and offer the most comprehensive range of small cap equities out there compared to other spread betting companies. We're quite unique in that not all the spread betting companies like to offer equities to begin with, let alone small caps. Quite frankly, it's a lot easier to wrap a spread around the price of the Dow Jones and let people have a go at that. We like to broaden our offering for all clients who like to do it. It's obviously very popular with yourself and lots of people like yourself, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
We like to offer as many stocks as we possibly can. That quite often depends on how our ability to hedge our risk ourselves. That is to bet the same way as our clients. And the reason we sometimes can't do that basically depends on one of the prime brokers we use allowing us to trade in that stock ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something we try and do.
Brilliant. I mean, I always think there are two types of spread bet clients, really. There's the punter, who basically just wants to gamble on indices, forex, gold, you name it, anything, and uses tons of gearing and eventually blows up, which is pretty much exactly what happened to me in 2008. but I've learned from my experiences, hopefully, and now I manage risk much more carefully. So hopefully now I'm the second type of spread bet clients, which is investors who are taking advantage of the tax-free status of spread bets, and who are managing, you know, the gearing very carefully, and focusing on what you're good at, which in my case, hopefully, theoretically, is small caps. So, I mean, does that ring true with you?
Well, it does. I mean, I think it's important to clarify as well that there are a lot of punters in the small cap world as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people having a punt, having big bets aren't just on, you know, your FX and Dow Jones.
Yeah.
It can also extend to kind of small cap companies. You're exactly right, though. There are, maybe there's a few more than two distinct types of clients, but you certainly do get that client who is basically looking to hit the home run with every single trade they do.
Yeah.
And ultimately, as I'm sure you'll know better than I do, Paul, that is just an unrealistic prospect.
Mm.
And,
well, so, in the long run, it can sometimes work well in the short run, can't it?
Well, exactly, yeah. And quite often you'll get clients who might hit that home run early on and they're emboldened by that and they think it's their own genius rather than maybe a bit of luck in the markets. And then that can be quite damaging in the long run. But, I mean, certainly what we really try and strive hard for at Spreadex is, I mean, obviously we treat all our clients equally and fairly, etc. But we're really keen for those clients who do take care of themselves, who know what they're doing, who look after themselves, because that does most of our job for us. We want long-term winning clients, because a long-term winning client is a client of ours for a number of years, hopefully. rather than someone who is trading away one day but then gone the next week.
Yeah, understood. So quite a lot of, let's get on to the reader questions now. Quite a lot of them concern sort of which I've categorised as customer behaviour. So Invested Geordie and John and Epson and Robert Hill have all asked questions about customer behaviour. So to amalgamate their questions into one, I think the best one is this. It's, what are some of the common traits that identify winning and losing clients?
I'd say one of the most common... Now, winning clients, there's all, people have all different kinds of methods and different things they do. What's probably easier to talk about is the losing clients. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the most common traits amongst clients who underperform is overactivity. They're too active on the markets. They feel they need to be doing something every second, react to every announcement, and essentially overtrade and get themselves in a bit of a tangle. And that's quite common on any market, whether that be some small cap stock or cable the last few days off the back of the Bank of England stuff. Overtrading and kind of being too keen to always be tinkering is quite a common trait amongst those who aren't as successful.
Yeah, so I mean, thinking specifically about the small caps clients, I mean, where I went wrong in 2008 was that I massively oversized one particular position, so that my gearing was off the scale almost. And then, you know, when the market started to tank, we couldn't get out of that position. That's been kind of fixed by the tiered margin system now, hasn't it?
It has. And, I mean, you've got to remember, I mean, just talking quickly about your specific situation, Paul, you were quite a large client at the time. Mm-hmm. Most clients we have aren't affected by market liquidity. I mean, obviously, it can have some effects, but you have some clients who might only have a 5,000 share position, 10,000 share position, which at the best of time, even in cases of extreme liquidity problems, can still deal out of that position. I think quite a common problem, though, and you touched on it just then, is the overgearing, and people just simply don't allow their trade or their trades or whatever they picked enough chance to breathe. So you know, they will pay on, I don't know, a few thousand pounds onto their account and will take out the maximum position they can, which basically means that their trading becomes a hostage to fortune, hostage to the next stock movement. So they might be right in the long run, but if the stock doesn't go up in a straight line as soon as they buy it, then they've been closed out before they can reap the benefits of the stock going upwards.
So
quite often people put themselves in a position where if they don't get their timing spot on, they need to make a payment or a series of payments quickly, and if they can't do that for whatever reason, then their position will be closed out. Mm-hmm. And then even if the stock then subsequently does go up, they no longer have the position.
Okay. And then John asks, is there any truth in the maxim that 90% of spread bettors lose 90% of their money within 90 days?
We don't... Look, I'm going to sound like a politician answering this. We actually don't track figures like this, to be perfectly honest. I would say, I don't have anything to prove this, but I'd be fairly confident in saying this, that our... percentage of winning clients is much higher than competition, than other spread betting companies. Look, we do have our fair share of clients who do get things wrong very quickly. They make some of the mistakes we just touched on. And this might be, I think people sometimes have a certain view of spread bettors, but believe it or not, quite often when that's happening, the guys on the desk will be sat there with their head in their hands thinking, what is this guy doing? You know, we can't advise, so we can't call up the client and say, look, I don't think you should do this, I think you should do that. Mm-hmm. Quite often we wish we could do that. But that does happen. But, I mean, certainly from our perspective, it's it's probably less so than some of our competition. We do a lot more equities. Clients who deal in equities typically do a lot better than clients who predominantly trade in FX.
Mm.
So some of our competition who have a lot of their business weighted to those markets, that is probably a lot more true than us.
Yeah, okay. Moving on next to gearing. This question is actually from me. And again, I'm thinking about specifically small caps here. Have you got a view on what the maximum level of gearing in small caps that punters should, or investors should consider safe?
I mean, obviously every stock's different. If we're specifically looking at small caps, I do think that, as you touched on before, liquidity is very important.
Mm-hmm.
As you gear up more, then obviously you're going to have a bigger position, and therefore the liquidity of the stock becomes more of a thing you should keep an eye on.
Mm.
Look, I mean, I guess every stock is different. We have a barometer for every stock. We have a risk figure that says to a 99% degree of confidence how much that stock would move in any day. And even in the small cap world, you have quite varying degrees of riskiness within stocks. So obviously you'd have to look at past performance or past movement, how volatile that stock is. But look, I'd say if you were going beyond, say, 5-to-1 leverage, 4-to-1 leverage, then you'd have to be quite careful. But obviously, ultimately, it really does depend on the stock you're dealing in.
Yeah.
If you're dealing in a stock, I don't know, let's think of an example, something like Pantheon Resources, who had a bit of a meteoric rise about a year ago, and it was just going up and up and up every day. If you're getting yourself overly geared in that stock, there is a chance that that stock won't continue to go up in a straight line.
Yeah.
And you need to be very careful.
I mean, just to give my view on this, I mean, I now keep a spreadsheet where I work out the actual gearing on each position and then the total consolidated gearing on all my spread bet accounts. And I have an absolute maximum, total maximum limit, and only in a bull market of 3x gearing.
Yeah, sure.
Which to a lot of people, they would still think that's far too high. And then, I mean, I'm comfortable around 2x gearing now across a portfolio of about 50 different stocks. And also I size each position now so that I can get out in one day. And I think that's the key thing for me is not, gearing itself is not necessarily dangerous, but I think when you combine gearing and illiquidity, that's what I repeatedly say in my blog, that's when it gets so dangerous. And I think people spread bet on the wrong type of shares. To my mind, I like spread betting on safe, fairly bulletproof small caps that pay divvies and have net cash in the bank, because you know the downside is limited on that. So if you then gear up on a safe stock, you're making a safe stock exciting, aren't you? Whereas,
and I agree. And then
people punt on these blue sky things, and gearing up 4 or 5x on a blue sky stock is madness, I think.
Well, exactly. We're going back to the clients who want to hit a home run. They want to hit it out of the park every single trade, and they're not happy if they haven't doubled their money inside a week.
Mm.
And I agree, that is the wrong way to look at it. And particularly when you talk about your safer, more boring stocks, perhaps, it's the clients who are more diversified as well. Like gearing's a lot different. If you're 3-to-1 geared on one stock, it's a hell of a lot different than being 3-to-1 geared on a basket of 10, 15
stocks.
Exactly,
so a profit warning will just make a slight dent in your portfolio in the basket of 10, won't it? Whereas
exactly,
it could wipe you out if it's more than a 25% drop. Yeah.
Okay,
great. Now, we touched on hedging before, so we've had three readers ask about hedging arrangements called Daniel Bird, Ian B, and Always Sunny. So I've condensed it down just to one, and it basically, so the question is, do you hedge small caps trades, and also do you offer stop losses on small caps?
First of all, yes, we do hedge small cap trades. We've got a number of prime broker arrangements with some of the big tier one banks that everyone will be familiar with. As I touched on earlier, hedging the small cap trades is very hard. When you approach an investment bank and you want to trade with them, they're very happy when you say you're just going to be trading Vodafone and BP and the like. When you turn around to them and say we'll be trading Gear for Music and Sound Energy, then they're not as enthused. But we do hedge those. We do hedge those stocks, like I touched on before. If yourself, Paul, came on, like you do quite often, and buy 10,000 shares of a small cap stock, we will be betting the same way. We will be buying that 10,000 shares,
mm-hmm.
and we make our money by simply charging you more of a spread than we get charged by our clients.
Yep.
So we do, I mean, if we're simply talking about small cap,
mm-hmm.
We do hedge, the hedge ratio is a lot higher than the rest of our book.
Yes.
Obviously, when we've got clients trading the FTSE, you get a lot more two-way flow, so clients do hedge themselves. Like when you get one client buying £5 a point of FTSE,
mm-hmm.
It's quite common to that exact same time to have a client selling £5 of FTSE.
So you can offset the two within your own.
Yeah, so you offset your two. It just wouldn't be practical if you were hedging every single bet. Obviously, in small caps, the flow is normally one way. You have a much higher percentage of people buying than selling,
mm-hmm.
And the frequency of trades is a lot smaller, but we will hedge our risk. On the stops, we do on some, on those that trade sets that are electronically traded,
yep.
We're much happier to offer stops. The problem with offering stops on quote-driven trades, so where you're relying on the market makers to quote,
mm-hmm.
is, I mean, as I'm sure you might be able to explain a bit better than I can, if you're relying on the market makers to quote, then those quotes can go wide, and then if someone's, say you've got a stock that's 74 to 76, say, that could one morning open quite wide. It could open, a client could have their stop at 70, and the quote at 2 minutes past 8 could be 70 to 78. Now, technically, at that point, that stop is triggered.
Mm.
And that doesn't necessarily mean that the stock is trading that level. It's just an early quote. Come an hour later, at 5 past 9, it could be trading 74, 78 again. And we always have the dilemma, well, should we stop that client out or shouldn't we? And quite often we're judged by hindsight by some of our clients. If the stock continues to go down, then the answer is yes, he should have stopped me out. If the stock tightens up an hour later, then it's why on earth did he stop me out?
Yes.
It wasn't really there. So that can be more problematic. We are willing to do things on a bespoke basis.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, we like to steer away from stops on those kind of stocks. I'm not sure if you'd agree with me on this, Paul, but I'm not entirely sure stops on some of those small cap stocks is necessarily the best thing to do as a trader. I'm not sure what your opinion is on that.
Yeah, I mean, opinion differs on this, doesn't it? But my view is, I mean, I never use stop losses on individual stocks for the reason you say. You know, I mean, the quoted price on small caps is... the prices aren't real very often. You know, when you try and trade at the published prices, you can't. And, you know, an erratic trade can just go through and stop you out. So, no, I mean, I would... I suppose the only circumstance where I'd use a stop loss on a small cap is if it's something that's binary, you know, if it's something that's going to report that a drug trial has failed or something and drops 80%. But, I mean, I never invest in that type of thing anyway, so...
Yeah,
you know, for me, a stop loss is just a substitute for not doing enough research. But
and I think it's important to note that obviously, given as I said before, we are hedging our risk.
Yes.
It's important to note what a stop actually means. When a client places a stop on a market, when that stop triggers, it is an instruction from the client to sell that market at the best price we can, their position. Now, quite often in these small caps, that might be quoted in 10,000 shares. If a client has, say, 50,000 shares and the stop triggers, if we were to go to market on those 50,000 shares, we'll probably achieve a much worse price than what's on the screen.
Yep.
It could end up, you know, you're at the mercy of the market. If you go to a market maker in a stock that they quote in 10,000 shares and you say, I need to sell 50,000 at market, then you're probably going to achieve a much worse price than the bid on the screen.
Mm.
And... you know, that's not always what the client has in mind when they place that stop.
Yeah, so it's very different from large caps or indices putting on those.
The large cap in the indices where they're trading like water at the price and you can dump pretty much whatever size you want at that price, then that's not a dilemma. But obviously in the small cap world, it's completely different.
Yeah, okay. John asks quite an interesting question about working orders. He says, is the option to call up and ask SpreadX to work an order and deal inside the spread on small caps, as previously referred to by Paul, available to everyone? And do any minimum deal sizes apply?
We don't have any rules on that. We like to accommodate as much business as we possibly can. So if people want to call up and work orders, they're more than welcome to.
Mm-hmm.
We really do try and accommodate everyone and anyone in any size.
So that's not to say
that's not to say if we had a client who was calling up every 2 minutes to do absolute minimum size. Yeah. You know, we might then view that case by case, but we try and accommodate everyone. I always say to all the guys on the desk, look, the day the phones aren't ringing is the day we've got a problem. So we try and accommodate as much as we possibly can.
Okay, well, that's good to hear, because, I mean, one of my blog readers said, because I've said, on my blog that I do most of my small cap stuff through SpreadX, and one of the readers said, yeah, but the spreads are so wide on the sort of stocks we like. And I said, well, you don't pay the quoted spread that's on the website, you just ring them up. And if the quoted price is, say, 75p bid, 85p offer, me or my intermediary broker I use will call you and say, okay, Paul doesn't want to pay 85p, he wants to pay a halfpenny over the mid price.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
See if you can work an order for, I don't know, 10,000 shares or whatever. And very often we get filled, don't we? And you've then... And also the nice thing with these illiquid things as well, just a single trade will often then push the market price up.
Yeah.
So if you bought around the mid price, chances are you'll be at break even by lunchtime,
Yeah, and it's important to note that, I mean, we quite often do most of our small cap execution now on the RSP terminal, which is the market maker's electronic quoting system. So, and that is very often inside their official quoted spreads.
Yes.
So we're not trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes and quote wider spreads online.
Mm-hmm.
If we could quote off at RSP, we would be happy to, but it's not quite reliable. I don't want to turn this into a kind of a critique of market makers, but when you are dealing on the RSP, you are at the mercy of them, and it's less reliable as something for us to put our quotes on a website, but that is something that is available to all clients if they call up. We're more than happy to quote off that, give the tighter spread and...
Exactly, because I wouldn't use SpreadX if I was paying ridiculous prices on things. You know, I use SpreadX precisely because I get the same execution that I get through a normal telephone broker, basically. So okay, great.
And just on that, and like I said before, we want winning clients, so clients paying more spread away to the market means they can pay less commission to us, so we want our clients to get the best price they can, which means they can optimize their returns and place more trades with us.
Brilliant. We better just do quick fire. I've got another 10 questions, so if we can do shortish answers.
Yeah, sure. Sorry, am I rambling?
No, you're not. It's interesting, but I'm just conscious of time, as readers tend to drift away after about 20 minutes. listeners, rather. Now, Shine66 asks, he doesn't much like the idea. He's worried about this thing about losses can exceed deposit. So he says, is it possible to have a SpreadX account where I could select to limit my losses to my deposit?
We don't offer that currently, but obviously the easiest way to do that is simply you're not obliged to take out the gearing we offer.
Mm.
Clients can have an account with us where they put up 100% of the margin. They will still benefit from the tax advantages and any other services we have to offer. So we don't offer that account to clients at the moment. That
but the
actually
client
makes,
can create that.
But then obviously the client can impose that kind of restriction on themselves.
Yeah, and I know quite a lot of people actually who do exactly that. They don't use the gearing at all. They just put in 100% margin on every position, so they can never lose more than they put in. Okay. Next one is on... this is from Anonymous. They say, what is the funding cost charged to customers, and is this applied to the entire position size? If something goes up in price, will you then pay more funding cost on the bigger position?
The answer to that is yes and no. It depends which product you trade with us. We have For all our equities, we have different contracts. We either have the daily bet or one of the futures contracts.
Mm-hmm.
The main difference between the two, if you trade a futures contract, so that's just our own derivative product. So at the moment, we will have, it's actually the September expiry next week, but we'll have December and March future contracts. When you enter into a future contract, you're locking in your interest cost against the price that you enter in at. So even if the stock doubles in value, you won't pay any more funding on that because you would have paid that all up front in the futures price against the price it was on the day you bought. In the daily contract, the interest is debited each night, and that does react to the price of the stock each day.
Okay. That's interesting, because I use daily bets for everything, but I'd probably be better off using quarterlies, wouldn't I?
In
a bull market when they're rising.
Yeah, you know. I mean, using the simplest example as possible, if there was a stock today that was £1 a share and we knew this time next year it was going to be £5 a share,
mm-hmm.
you would be better off trading in the futures,
yeah.
locking in your interest charge at £1 a share.
Yeah, and the futures is the quarterly bets, isn't it?
The quarterly bets, exactly that, yeah. Conversely, obviously, if the stock halves in value, you would have paid interest against £1 a share.
Right.
And it's now 50p. So it does work both ways. It's important to mention that, but that is the main difference between the two contracts.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that, so thanks for that, Tom. Right. Now we've got about six or seven what I call technical questions. Now, Rebecca says, I've noticed that my positions can go haywire at 12 noon, i.e. vastly different losses, gains 2 minutes before. What's happening?
Sorry, can you just repeat that one, Paul?
Yeah, she said she's noticed that her positions in individual shares can go haywire at 12 noon. I think it's probably the auction, isn't it?
Yeah, that is it. That will be the 12 o'clock auction.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure exactly which positions she has, but yeah, that will be the 12 o'clock auction.
Yeah, okay.
And it's 5 past 12.
Lasts about
yeah,
five
exactly.
minutes, doesn't it? I found that with another account, that it suddenly a huge margin call appears. Well, not huge, but you know, an
yeah.
unexpected margin call appears at noon and then disappears 5 minutes later.
Right. And you think the world's melting down, and then
yeah.
you realise it's a 12 o'clock auction.
Yeah, exactly. So everyone should probably take a tranquilizer at 5 to 12. Okay. Next one. This is from the Fool on the Hill, saying if a company is taken over and the shareholders are given shares in another company, how is a spread bet treated in that?
We will mirror whatever happens in the underlying market, which is exactly how the hedges we place are handled. We will mirror whatever happens.
Right. Okay. Great. Next one. This is from Mark. He asks, can they clarify what happens when a company's shares are suspended and then delisted,
sure.
And including the timescales?
Okay, so I believe the rule on AIM is if a stock has been suspended for 6 months, that is at the point it will be delisted.
I think, isn't it a month? Is it a month?
Sorry.
I don't know. InterQuest suspended, and if they don't find a new Nomad within a month, they said they would delist. I think it might be a month on AIM.
That might be if they've lost an... I'm a bit hazy, but if they've lost a Nomad, that might be different.
Yeah.
But in any case, at the point they get... So let's start from scratch. So you hold a stock that's trading, then it gets suspended.
Mm-hmm.
That position will remain open on your account. Obviously, you can't trade out of that.
Does it go to 100% margin when they're suspended?
Yes, that is something we are able to do. There's two things we can do. We can either market at zero or make it 100% margin. In effect, it's basically the same thing. What we would do after, typically the timescale we use is 6 months. After that 6 month period, we would close out the bet at zero,
yeah.
but then reopen a new bet at zero. So that's just for the records, and the client can still see it on their account. That means they are absorbing all the losses down to zero,
mm-hmm.
but then retain the position from zero. So if any value is ever returned or the share returns and starts trading again, then they have full benefit of any upside from that point.
Oh,
but it wouldn't be typically until the 6 months have passed by that we would realize the position at zero, realize the losses. But the client would maintain that position. I mean, we've got some clients with some ludicrous positions. It makes me feel my age, to be honest, when I see some of the stocks that clients still have positions on zero on the off chance that value might be returned at some point.
Oh, I see. Yes. So, well, I did hear of one spread-bet firm that apparently closed positions out at the price when the share was suspended, and then so they effectively pocketed all the gains.
Yeah, no, we certainly don't do that. And we, through no fault of our own, we used to deal at Commerzbank. They were one of our main providers.
Yeah.
They pulled out of the space about this time last year, but towards Christmas last year. And one of the main problems we had when we were unwinding that account was maintaining our hedges and our interest in suspended stocks from years gone by. So if any of them ever did return, we had the position ourselves to then be able to pass on to our clients. You know, it was the first time I heard the name Woolworths for about 10 years. it really was that kind of stuff.
Quite bizarre, yeah.
Yeah.
And similar to this, Fool on the Hill again asks about how a share suspension is treated in situations like CAML. I'm trying to think. Central Africa Mining, isn't it, that one?
Yeah.
He was suspended pending a deal. But he's asking specifically, if the spread bet expires, what happens?
We would roll that over. So
okay.
that would stay open.
Right, okay.
So anyone who has a suspended share with us, they will maintain that interest until it really is, until it either comes back and starts trading again or whatever happens, gets taken over or whatever might be happening, or it officially dies. They will maintain that interest until that point.
I found with Globo, when that went bust, I had a short position on it, and it wasn't actually with yourself, it was with another firm, and my short position, and they jacked it up to 100% margin, which was a nightmare because it suddenly consumed a great load of my available capacity on the account, and I then had to wait months, I mean a long time, 6 months or more maybe, for the position to be valued at zero. So I personally feel it's better to close out a short just before the company goes bust, and then you don't get all these problems. You know?
And in fairness to the providers, and this is a dilemma we have sometimes, is when a client's short in that position, if you were to close their position out at zero and realize that cash, so that client had that cash then on their ledger, they could place new trades or withdraw or do whatever, and that stock's marked at zero. If that stock ever was to return or was to have some value, and that client has already withdrawn all that money or placed it on other trades, then we've got a problem on our hands. We've got to then chase that client for whatever value had been returned. So that is a slightly trickier situation, and all situations are different, but that is slightly harder to handle.
Okay. Just two more questions left. Alan has got a little bit of a complaint, really. He said, I think this is relating to shorting on equities. He says, why have you started charging up to 10% for borrowing against your own book? The shorters actually reduce your costs in this case, yet you charge them.
Okay. Well, it's important first to mention that we only charge that amount when we are the ones providing the borrow. If there is borrow in the market and we can go short the stock, we pass on whatever charge, whatever borrow charge is in the underlying market, whatever we're paying. Look, I do accept this has been an issue for some people. For others, it's enabled people to go short stocks they weren't previously able to go short of. In the past, so we are providing that advantage. We are the people providing that borrow. And given we're one of the only companies, if not the only company doing that, and we might be the only people in the market providing that borrow, I don't think it's that unreasonable, therefore, to charge something for that.
Yes.
There are some problems it can cause, particularly around when the underlying client who's long closes out their position. And typically, when we tried to do this before, we had some problems around that, when we had to call back the client who was short, and they're all of a sudden uncontactable, and we've got a short position in the market that needs to be closed out, but we can't really do it before we get the client's approval. That can provide problems. It's an area where a dispute could arise, but ultimately, we don't feel it's that unreasonable where we are the people, the
You're
only people in the market providing it. People don't have to go short with us, but typically on some of these stocks, we're the only place they can go short. So we don't feel it's that unreasonable to therefore charge for that. But look, we're humble enough to, you know, we're happy to enter into conversation and dialogue with clients, explain in more detail. We don't want to be a brick wall on this stuff. We want to, you know, we don't want to piss people off, basically.
Okay. And just the last question then is just from Daniel Bird again. He asks about increased regulation. It sounds like it's designed to help inexperienced customers, but will it hamper things in future for the more experienced spreadbet clients?
Well, it's important at the moment just to highlight that as of right now, we're not entirely sure what the resulting regulation will be. We've obviously read the initial paper, like I'm sure a lot of people have. Going by what the initial paper said, I don't think that will hamper equities as much. It's certainly from a leverage perspective. So it was more designed at FX and stock indices and all the rest.
Yeah.
I think the FCA's guidelines on acceptable leverage for equities was 10%, so 10 to 1 leverage for experienced clients.
Which is huge, isn't it?
Yeah, and 5 to 1 for inexperienced clients.
Yeah.
It's still not entirely clear how they will classify experienced and inexperienced clients. But, look, on either one of those metrics, it still doesn't impede on the leverage we offer on those at the moment. So from a small cap perspective, and it's important to have the disclaimer that we're still not sure what's going to happen, we don't envisage that many problems. The problems are more, as you know, a lot of different spread betting companies in the industry, it's people offering, you know, pound against a dollar at 400 to 1 leverage. You know, it is primarily designed to tackle that.
Yeah, okay, brilliant. Well, that's finished all the reader questions, I think. So thanks ever so much, Tom. That was really, really useful. Sorry if it's a bit dry, but these are the specific questions
okay.
that the readers wanted answered, you know. So,
yeah, sure.
Any sort of closing points that you want to make?
Nothing particular. Thanks for having me on, Paul.
Enjoyed it.
Like I say, I'm more than happy to field any more questions, however they come, over the phone, email. We like to be as approachable as possible. So if anyone needs any more clarity, feel free to get in touch.
Fantastic.
However.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, thanks again, Tom. I'll let you go now. I think it's time for the pub, isn't
it? it literally is that time, yeah.
Definitely. Well, take care and thanks again, Tom. Much appreciated.
All right. Cheers, Paul. Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Bye.